Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, good morning and welcome to the Patrick Madrid Show, where you never know what kind of a conversation you might hear. And of course, it could be yours. If you want to give me a call, here's the number, 888-914-9149. We can get you on the air with your comment or question. Again, 888-914-9149. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this story, but I just want to bring it to your attention. I actually saw this on Twitter from a, I think it's called Gays Against Groomers account. That's the name of it. And I guess it's a cadre of homosexual folk who are speaking out against the transgender craze with kids and assorted other issues like that. So they had a story. I thought it was interesting. And it's about what's going on at Duke University with regard to pushing the transgender agenda on children. And by children, I mean like 2 years of age children. Here's the article. Transgender toddlers treated at Duke, UNC, and ECU, top medical schools in the state, are now transitioning toddlers and training future primary care doctors on how to engage in the experimental treatment. Duke Medicine opened its gender clinic in 2015 to offer a wide variety of services under one roof. And we could put the word services in quotation marks. We have a lot of services we'd like to tell you about here. The clinic treats children as young as two. Did you hear that? Two. They treat them for alleged gender dysphoria. Dr. Deanna Adkins, a transgender activist who runs the clinic, said this about her toddler trans patients in an interview with the Charlotte Observer. This is back in 2016. They're not old enough to consciously just choose to do that. It's not a choice in any of my patients. It's really an unpleasant thing to have going on in your body to feel that distress about yourself. I can't imagine anyone would choose to do that. Me either. In her expert declaration to a federal district court in North Carolina concerning House Bill 2, she said, from a medical perspective, the appropriate determinant of sex is gender identity, arguing that gender identity is not only the preferred basis for determining sex, but, quote, the only medically supported determinant of sex. And she somehow is a doctor. She says every other method of determining what your sex is, male or female, is what she calls bad science. You know, the kind of science that was taught in medical schools from time immemorial, since we've had the capability to peer more deeply into such things. She says it's counter to medical science to use chromosomes, hormones, internal reproductive organs, external genitalia, or secondary sex characteristics to override gender identity for purposes of classifying someone as a male or female. Did you get that? Now, the article says this ludicrous sentiment explains how this doctor can see a two-year-old girl play with a toy truck and then begin treating her for gender dysphoria, which is what they're doing. A few miles away at UNC Health, children as young as three can be evaluated for gender dysphoria. The clinic states it practices gender-affirming care, which is gender transitioning, on its intake form. And here's a section from the intake form. Welcome to the Gender Equity and Wellness Initiative Program. So they have a series of things that you can fill out. What is your affirmed name? That is the name you'd like us to call you. What are your pronouns? What is your gender identity? Now, they give some prompts, female, male, non-binary, trans, gender queer, or something else. What is your sex assigned at birth? Now, obviously, a two-year-old can't fill this out. Female, male, intersex, date of birth, today's date, referring provider, medical record name, medical record, et cetera, et cetera. Reasons for a referral, and you can check off as many as apply. Young child, ages 3 to 11, psychoeducation and support for child and family. guidance on social transitioning and access to resources, support and resources for exploring gender identity and expression. Children as young as 3 are being put through this process. And there are 4, 5, 6, 7 more things that they can check. Interested parents are assured on the UNC website that a team of psychiatrists, endocrinologists, family doctors, and surgeons will call surgeons. Those are the people with scalpels. That they will collaborate to, quote, affirm their children's, these children's gender. Yeah, they want to affirm you real good. We're going to affirm you real good and make a whole lot of money from the insurance companies in doing so. You should read this. I'm not going to read the whole thing to you. I'm just giving you some lowlights from the article, but it is, this is happening to children as young as 2 years old under the guise of medicine in big time hospitals that have it, you know, at least ostensibly they have reputations for being leaders in the field. Of course, I think they're leading people straight to hell with this craziness. So be aware of it. Cyrus is going to post that. He probably already has by now. He's quick on the draw. He would have done well in the Old West. Cyrus, you know that, don't you? You're quick on the draw.
This is infuriating, Patrick.
It is.
These are doctors that have taken an oath to protect and help people.
And Cyrus,
I'm so angry.
You don't understand. They want to affirm you. They're going to affirm you so much. You won't even know who you are when they're done affirming you. You won't even recognize yourself when they're done affirming you. They're going to affirm you real good. You know what I'm saying?
I don't understand. I don't understand how a doctor, how do you sleep at night? How do you look at yourself in the mirror after mutilating a child?
Exactly. Well, and we're talking about an assembly line of children going through these doors. You know, they go in the doors as a little 2-year-old girl or boy. I don't even want to think about this nightmare of what happens.
Cha-ching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the thing.
Cha-ching.
They're making money hand over fist to do this. Hand over fist. They can't keep up with as much money as they're making doing this. And naturally, if there weren't any money, they probably wouldn't be so gung-ho about doing this. But there's a lot of money to be made. Follow the money, as they say.
Well, it's frowned upon when they kill them when they're not born yet. So now we'll just kill them when they're 2.
Or if not kill, I mean, that's
it's a slow death.
That's an unpleasant term to use, Cyrus. They're affirming these kids, don't you understand? They're affirming them. I'm with you 100%. I'm with you 100%, but we have to shine a light on this. You know, it's like when you're staying at some place or you're staying in a budget hotel or something like that, and you go into the kitchenette to get a glass of water, you flick on the light, and all the cockroaches start scurrying. I've seen that a time or two on my travels. And that's what needs to happen. The cockroaches, and here we go. People say, you're dehumanizing people. You're calling for people to be seen as something less. No, I'm not. Okay. It's the equivalent of when something bad is going on in the darkness, you want to shine a light on it. That's the point I'm trying to make. So thank you for posting the article.
Not much else is darker. This is about as dark as it gets.
It really is. It really, really is. So do it for the children, everybody. Mama, don't let your boys grow up to be, what would we call them, transgender physicians to treat kids. I'll have to come up with a rhyming term for that. 888-914-9149. Let's go, where are we going to go? Let's go to Vivian in Anaheim, California. Good morning, Vivian. Thank you for waiting.
Hi. Good morning, Patrick.
Yes, good morning.
Nice talking to you. I'm
yes.
so honored.
You're very kind.
My question is, yes, my question is, I'm reading your book, Why Be Catholic?
Mm-hmm.
And on the story about the apparition of Our Lady of Guadalupe,
yeah.
You mentioned, the tilma. I am just wondering, what is tilma? Is it the material or a stone where the image of the lady was imprinted?
Yes, it's more the latter. So the word tilma, it's the word for the garment that St. Juan Diego was wearing. So it was, we might call it a poncho. I mean, that was popular in the, you know, in the 1970s. You're probably far too young to remember that, but there was a style fashion kind of called a poncho. But in this case, it was made for work. So the rustic people would wear this to do things like carry firewood or carry animals or other things. So it was a long garment. There was a hole in the middle for your head, and then it would come down maybe to your knees or even further in the front, and about the same in the back. And it was for weather purposes. So if it was cold, you would wear that to stay warm. But you also used it to work, to carry things. So you'd lift up the bottom front of the garment, and you would put firewood in there or other things like that. So that's what he was wearing, and that's called a tilma. And so that's what the image of Our Lady was miraculously imprinted upon. In a miraculous way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's just like what?
It's just like a coat, right?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's a coat per se. It's not something that you would button up. It's not like put a coat on and button it up. It's something that would go over your head, and it would go over your shoulders.
Oh, yeah. I know a poncho. Uh-huh.
Yeah, or a cloak.
Okay.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay.
Are you enjoying that book, by the way, Vivian? Why Be Catholic?
Yes, I'm learning a lot. You're so good. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Vivian. Well, let's see, 888-914-9149. We do have a couple lines open. I can see people getting ready to get on the air. When you call in, by the way, you're going to talk to young Thomas, and he will get your basic info, what your name is, where you're from. He'll also tell you not to be on a speakerphone. So be prepared. And if you want to call in, we do have a line or two open, 888-914-9149. We'll start with Gray now in Alameda, California. Good morning, Gray.
Morning, Patrick. So my question today is that over the next couple of weeks, I'm going to be traveling with my mom, and she was Catholic and has all of her sacraments, but has not been in the church for a long time.
Okay.
And aside from that, there's a few specific things that would prevent her from receiving communion that aren't really immediately correctable, and I was wondering if you had any advice on how to maybe go about that.
Does she show signs of wanting to resume a practice of her faith? Do you think she's warming up again to the idea of getting back into a regular practice of her faith, or do you think she's just going to go to church with you because you happen to be traveling together?
I don't know. It might be possible. She did this past Lent, sort of participate and do that, but that's the most I could say. It's not like she's been actively doing anything other than that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, well, and the reason I asked that question is because it might help you discern how best to talk to her. If she's just doing this in a perfunctory way, she's just doing it because she happens to be at church with you. She wouldn't otherwise go to church if she weren't traveling with you. She may not be interested in what it would mean for her to come back to a practice of the faith. But then again, you may not know. That could be right there beneath the surface. Maybe she is far more interested and ready than she might let on. So one way that you could talk to her about this would be to say, you know, Mom, I really am hopeful that at some point soon, God willing, that you will become Catholic again and that you will start receiving the sacraments again. And one thing to remember is that all that you need to do to be ready to receive the Jesus and the Blessed Sacrament at Mass is go to confession. And you don't need to tell me anything personal, Mom. I respect your privacy. But if you've been away from the Catholic Church, or since you've been away from the Catholic Church for a long time, you really do need to go to confession and get everything cleared up before you receive Holy Communion. And you can do that. And look at all these different churches that we'll be visiting, and you can make an appointment with the priest or go there when the scheduled hours are for confession and get that taken care of. And then you won't have to worry. Your conscience won't bother you a bit if you're receiving communion once you've made a good confession. Now, that could be the beginning of a deeper, longer conversation. Or she might say, oh, no, I'm never going to go to confession. Been there, done that. I mean, who knows what her reaction might be? I don't know. But that would bring to the surface what's going on, chances are. And then once you see that, then you'll know which direction to go in. And if she says, well, I would never go to confession, I don't believe in the Catholic Church anymore, then say, oh, okay, well, Mom, it makes me sad to hear that. And I hope and pray that you will come home someday. But in the meantime, be sure not to go to communion because you're not prepared to receive communion. You haven't been to confession. You've been away from the church, away from Mass for a long time. So you're not ready to receive communion. It would actually be spiritually harmful for you, the sin of sacrilege. But if she says, well, you know, that's a good point. I might like to come back. Well, here's how you can do it, Mom. Go to confession, get back on track, and then you can start receiving communion. So either way, you can give her good advice, and also in a loving and respectful way, you can point out to her that if she hasn't, or since she hasn't been to confession for a long time, she should not be receiving communion at all. That might get her wheels turning.
Mm-hmm. That's where there's a little bit of a hiccup, because okay, when I said that there are some things that aren't immediately like to be rectified, my parents were married in the Catholic Church, but they are divorced now. Mm-hmm. So
are they remarried either? Or no. In her case, is she remarried?
Oh, no, neither of them are.
That's not a barrier. That's something. Okay. Yeah. So here's what would happen. And we can't know what's going on in your mom's private life. But let's just say she goes to confession. Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. It's been 20 years since my last confession. I've been away from the church. Here are my serious sins. She goes through numbering kind. She says, my husband and I got divorced 20 years ago, and I haven't remarried, and I was the cause of the divorce. I'm just shooting a dart here. So she may say, I was the cause of the divorce. I'm the one who walked out. So if she's a victim of the divorce, that's different. But if she's the one who caused the divorce, that's just something, that's a line item that you bring up in confession.
Mm.
So that is not an insurmountable problem at all. Now, if she had been divorced and remarried, that'd be a different story, because now she's got an existing situation that also could be rectified, quite frankly, if she were to decide to live as brother and sister with this man until such time as she knew whether she would be free to try to marry him. That's where the annulment comes in. But it doesn't sound like that's an issue here.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Hey, by the way,
go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, this is completely out of left field, but have you ever heard of the author Graham Greene?
No, I haven't.
He's a great, I mean, he's gone now, but he was just a really good author. He wrote a book about a kind of a whiskey priest in Mexico during the persecution in the 1920s. It's called The Power and the Glory. It's really good. He also wrote a book called Travels with My Aunt. And you're talking about travels with your mom. You might enjoy this book. It's a novel, as all of his books are. And the title of it, what you said reminded me of this book. So you might enjoy it. By Graham Greene. It's called Travels with My Aunt.
Okay. How would I go about spelling his name?
Graham, like Graham Cracker, G-R-A-H-A-M.
Got it.
Graham. I wouldn't eat ham that's gray. Graham Green.
I also wouldn't eat ham that's green.
Yeah, or green eggs and ham. G-R-E-E-N-E. An aside, this is an empty calorie as far as the show is concerned, but I thought you might find it interesting.
Okay, well, thanks.
All right.
As a last-minute addition, if you have time, I had a song you might be interested in for Taco Tuesday.
Oh?
If you're not familiar with it, Taco Grande by Weird Al Yankovic.
Oh. Cyrus, weigh in on this. You're the Weird Al expert on the show.
Why have I not thought of that before? Wow. I cannot believe I missed the boat on that.
You blew Cyrus's mind just now, Gray.
Yep, there was that fruit was hanging there this whole time, and I missed it. So thank you, Gray.
Thanks, Gray. So, Gray, from now on, when you hear that song played, you know why we're playing it. Because of you. This isn't it, by the way. Thanks, Gray. Great talking to you. I bet I'm the first one ever to say that. Thank you. I'll be right back.
Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Our sponsor, Christendom College, offers our listeners access to free online classes at getprinciples.com/truth. Acclaimed philosopher Dr. John Cutteback is teaching a class now, Understanding Human Nature, at getprinciples.com/truth.
Keeping it relevant. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
That's how I feel right now, talking with you. Thank you for listening to the Patrick Madrid Show. Number 888-914-9149. Let's go to Denise in St. John, Indiana. Hi, Denise.
Hi, Patrick. Calling you again. I'm sort of embarrassed. As a cradle Catholic, I've heard you talk about apologetics, and yesterday I wrote down some things. But my real question is, when did it start, and how come most of us don't know about it? Most of my friends that are Catholic, and I did write down things that I can study, but when did this all start?
Oh, my. Well, gosh, no need to feel sheepish about that. apologetics is simply the process of explaining why you believe what you believe. It's really as simple as that. So when somebody says, "Oh, you're Catholic? Why are you Catholic?" And you start saying, "Well, I'm Catholic because it's the church Jesus started," and whatever other reasons you might bring to bear, you're actually doing apologetics. So it's not something just for a certain group of people. It's really for everybody. The Bible says we should always be ready to give a defense to anyone who asks us for a reason for the hope that is in us, St. Peter says. So it's for all God's people, in each in their own way, according to their own time and temperament. So where did it start? Well, I mean, strictly speaking, you can see it starting in the New Testament, because St. Peter, St. Paul, St. Stephen, the first martyr, they were all what we might call proto-apologists, proto meaning like the first, and they defended the claims of Jesus, the claims they were making about Jesus, that he rose from the dead, for example, that he is Lord, that if you want to be saved, you have to believe in Jesus. And there were plenty of there was plenty of opposition from the Jews, from the Gentile pagans, for example. And so they were hip deep in apologetics for many years. And you read about that, and you read about their defenses of Jesus. Now, early on, that passed after the time of the apostles, that passed, once we get to the second century, it passes into the hands of those who either knew the apostles or they knew people who knew the apostles. St. Justin Martyr, for example, St. Irenaeus, some of the great figures who were known, by the way, as apologists because they would write defenses of Christianity. In the case of St. Justin Martyr, he wrote a defense of Christianity, but in response to a Jewish critic. He also wrote to the Roman emperor and defended Christianity and said, "We are not guilty of all these terrible crimes that our detractors accuse us of. We stand up for the truth of Jesus." And he wrote these long apologetics tractates to defend the faith. And then you see it just continuing. In every generation, there were always men and women who undertook to defend and explain the faith. So apologetics, if you want to think of it this way, can be understood as one of a series of one of three categories, let's say. The first and most important is evangelization, and that is speaking the truth, telling people the good news. Then you have catechesis, which is forming people in the knowledge of the gospel. So if they've heard the message, they've heard the good news, they've come to faith in Jesus, well, now they need to be formed. So that's catechetics. And then the third, and I would argue the least important of the three, is apologetics. And that's simply the process of clearing up misunderstandings, responding to objections, helping people overcome resistance to things like, well, why should I believe in God? Or why should I believe that Jesus is God? Or why should I believe that the wafer is really the true presence of Jesus, body, blood, soul, and divinity? That's where apologetics comes in, because you're helping to remove obstacles. But it's just one of those three, and I would argue the least important of the three. So in an historical sense, that's where, from a Christian standpoint at least, that's where this got started. Now, it has become a more specialized field, and I myself have taken part in that for going on close to 40 years now, not quite 40 years, but the art of apologetics was very present and even strong in many seminaries in the early part of the 20th century. But by the time you get, let's say, to the 1960 mark, just before Vatican II, there were a lot of changes going on in society, certainly a lot of changes going on in the church. And one of the unfortunate side effects of a misguided understanding of Vatican II was this notion that defending the faith or apologetics was retrograde. It was pre-Vatican II, which was just a dumb epithet. And in fact, everything is pre-Vatican II. The Bible, Jesus, everything is pre-Vatican II prior to that time. But it was an epithet that was used to try to discourage people from seeing apologetics as anything valuable, but rather to see it as something that would hinder ecumenism. And they would argue that it smacked of triumphalism, because you're claiming things that you have no right to say, that you're right and other people are wrong. And it was just a really messy, weird time. And I remember it as a child in the 60s. I certainly remember it as a high school and college student in the 70s. But what happened was apologetics began to resurface. And this was at the, let's just say, in the early to mid 1980s, people like Carl Keating, for example, who was one of the few people in the United States, at least, who was doing apologetics. And he did it at a personal sort of a hobby level, because he was incensed about an anti-Catholic leaflet that was put on his car and a bunch of other cars in the Catholic parish when he went to Mass one Sunday in a fundamentalist Protestant church was responsible for that. So that made him angry. So he went home and did some homework, and he wrote his own tract responding to all of those arguments. And then he went to the church that had been responsible for distributing those in the Catholic parking lot. And while they were in their Sunday service, he and some of his buddies, they put his tract on all of the cars in that church. And that's what started and eventually became Catholic Answers. So that was, I don't know, maybe that was 79 or 80, right in that area. Well, through a series of fortunate events, I came into the picture in late 87. I got to know Carl in early 87. And by the end of that year, beginning of 1988, I was now working with him at Catholic Answers, which at that time was just practically a two-room enterprise. And there were like three people, and that was it. And this was before the internet, so there was no website. There were no conferences. His first book was yet to come out. It would come out later that spring. And so there really wasn't much of anything in the world of apologetics, but Carl really pioneered this organization, Catholic Answers, into something huge now. It's a big and very successful and very important organization doing apologetics work. We should all be grateful for that. But my point here, and I'll throw it back to you if you're interested, Denise, is just that from that point, there seemed to be an explosion of apologetics interest, because so many people in those days, Denise, you may remember them, they were really bothered by the the Protestant arguments against the Catholic faith, and people were becoming Protestant, and the Catholic folk didn't know how to respond to their challenges. Why do you call priests father? Why do you worship Mary? Well, we don't worship Mary. And on and on and on. So there was such a great hunger for information and material that not only did Catholic Answers flourish, but other organizations and spontaneous like Scott Hahn, for example, just sort of seemingly out of nowhere, this guy just appeared with this wonderful pedigree of having been a Protestant minister, and he was deeply involved in apologetics as a Catholic convert. And so I do believe being there to witness the whole thing come into existence seemingly out of nothing. I believe this was God's providence. And at a time when people really desperately wanted and needed information to explain and defend their faith, God worked among his people and brought out the Catholic apologetics movement. And I also believe, for what it's worth, Denise, that this was a precursor to other challenges that would come, the challenge of atheism, which followed in the next decade or two. That's when that wave hit. And now, of course, we're being hit with the wave of a flight from reality, people completely denying the reality of male and female, and things of that nature. So we can all be grateful to God for the rise of Catholic apologetics, because without it, we would have no tools to respond adequately to the crazy that's going on right now. So anyway, there's my little speech. Mm-hmm. What do you think, Denise?
Well, you know what? I love it. This is going to be my new project to learn more about it. But you know what got me? I think it's the word apologetics. In my mind, I thought, are we apologizing, you know, for the Crusades? Are we apologizing for this? That's where I got confused. But yeah. I see what you're saying, because as a teacher, I must be doing some apologetics, because yes, I do have to inform. But yeah, the word apologetics is what caught me. But
Let me help with that, just to give you a little added information here. So apologetics, it derives from a Greek word, apologion, and it means to defend. It means to defend. So the traditional meaning of that word in antiquity, both in Greek as well as in Latin, because it's a cognate in Latin, and it means to defend or explain is another way that you could translate it. So when in more modern times the word apology or apologize shifted in its meaning, it took on the connotation of being that you regret something. I apologize for what I said. I apologize for being late. So it took on that meaning, but that's a purely modern meaning. That's not what the word apology meant for countless centuries. It always meant, primarily at least, to defend and explain. So what we're dealing with is our own modern 21st century and even 20th century Western English-speaking thought categories. But the word apologetics is ancient, and it means to defend, as I say. So when you look at a book, for example, like by St. John Henry Newman, one of his, if not the classic book, is Apologia Pro Vita Sua. That's the Latin for an apology for his life. But the word apology doesn't mean he's sorry for what he did. It's a defense for what he did by leaving the Church of England and becoming Catholic. So that's where you see an example of apology in its true sense of the word. So no, we don't apologize for being Catholic. We don't say, oh, gee, I'm really sorry, I don't know what to tell you. Rather, it is in that classic sense of the term.
Perfect. Thank you so much again.
You're welcome, Denise. Great chatting with you. And as a parting gift, let me recommend an excellent book. It's by the late, great Cardinal Avery Dulles, D-U-L-L-E-S. By the way, he was the son of the former Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles. And the book is called A History of Apologetics. A History of Apologetics. And he was made a cardinal by Pope John Paul II. He was a Jesuit priest, a scholar, and a powerful figure in theological circles in the 20th century. And this was one of his final works. It's a very comprehensive tome of, I don't know, 300-400 pages. And it's an historical overview of apologetics, who the people were, what they did, what they discussed, who their opponents were. I was in apologetics for years before this book came out. And when I first got it and devoured it, I realized there is so much more about this that I never knew. So it was very informative for me, A History of Apologetics. And we'll get a link to that so people can check it out. I think you'd really enjoy it. We're going to take a break, and we'll come right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. And if you're listening someplace far away from the United States, please tell your friends, wherever you are, Philippines,
Grande,
Zambia, where else? China,
Taco,
France. Wherever you are, tell your friends about Relevant Radio and have them get the app.
Taco. Grande.
This hour is sponsored by Notre Dame Federal Credit Union. Get the best premiums and discounts, all without charging fees, through Mission Insurance Solutions, part of the Notre Dame Federal Credit Union family. Go to yourmissioninsurance.com. That's yourmissioninsurance.com.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149.
Taco.
That's 888-914-9149.
Grande.
Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Taco.
This is new.
What do you think?
This is good.
So this is Gray. Gray now, suggested this. And now
let me hear what he's saying here.
Siempre muy bueno y el chile relleno. You see, I just gotta have a tostada, carne asada. That's right, I want the whole enchilada. My only addiction has to do with a flour tortilla. I need a quesadilla. I love to stuff my face.
There you go. Thank you, Weird Al.
Yeah, thank you, Gray.
Yeah, national treasure, that guy.
Gray?
Gray.
He is now. He made his mark.
He is in the Taco Tuesday Hall of Fame.
He made his mark, didn't he?
Yep.
So this is going Tuesday. In the canon of approved music for Taco Tuesday.
I hope so.
I like it.
You give it a thumbs up?
I do. Who's he spoofing, though?
I have no idea. Yeah, tell me on Twitter.
Grande. This show is muy grande.
All right, back to work.
All right. Muchas enchiladas, everybody. Oh, by the way, I almost sounded like Father Simon there for a second. Cinco de Mayo. All right. Attention, Americans. Cinco de Mayo is not Mexican Independence Day. FYI.
What?
They won a battle against the French in Puebla.
This is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
I've marveled at how they think they're celebrating like the 4th of July in Mexico. That's not what it is. It's also not Cinco de Drinco, which is what most Americans think.
That's why we celebrate it.
Cinco de Drinco.
Yep.
Olé.
For those that need an excuse to party.
I know. I always smirk. It's not Mexican Independence Day. Anywho.
Is it still okay to...
Cinco de Drinco?
Yeah, to have some fun, play some Mexican music.
Oh, of course. Absolutely.
Shoot our guns
as
in
long
the air?
As you. No. I don't recommend that. Yeah. Depends on where you live. If you're inside city limits, definitely don't do that. And don't do it anyway, because what goes up must come down. So whatever you fire in the air is going to come down, hopefully not hit somebody. But it's nice. I mean, it's nice. Everybody, I mean, like on St. Patrick's Day, everybody wants to be Irish. You know, on Cinco de Drinco, Americans like to eat Mexican food and think they're celebrating this, you know, whatever.
We do it in Mexico all the time.
Anyway, happy Cinco de Mayo. And celebrate responsibly, right?
There's a bunch of people looking at their radios right now and being like, no, he's wrong.
No, what they're doing is they're searching on Wikipedia to check. Here's what happened. Maximilian von Habsburg, who was the younger brother of Franz von Habsburg, who was the emperor of Austria-Hungary. He didn't really have a job, and he wanted a for real job. So the sort of a group of people in Mexico who opposed Benito Juarez and they opposed the Republican form of government. We're not talking about Democrat and Republican. We're talking about the Republican form of government. And they opposed, you know, Freemasonry and a lot of the stuff that was going on. They petitioned Maximilian, who was living in Vienna or wherever he was, would you please come to Mexico and be our emperor? And he really wanted to do that because he didn't have much of a job back home because his older brother was the emperor. And so he was persuaded to do that. And in so doing, Maximilian had to forfeit and like legally detach himself or renounce any of his connection to the royal family in terms of like succession or being an heir to the throne or anything. He had to like irrevocably turn his back on all of that. And he did. And Napoleon III, who was the head of France at that time, he ponied up a lot of money because the French had interests in exploiting Mexico. So Maximilian was like the perfect guy because he was like this puppet figure. He was ostensibly the emperor of Mexico. And so the French were underwriting this, and they had a bunch of troops, 20, 30, 40,000 troops in Mexico to kind of keep Maximilian propped up as this emperor. Well, what happened was, as Napoleon III's problems mounted back home, and he didn't have as much money to spend on this venture, and he didn't have as much interest anymore, little by little, he began withdrawing his power and support, and the French military presence began to degrade. And lo and behold, as the Republican forces under Benito Juarez and others like him began to surge, well, they beat the French at this decisive battle. But it wasn't, they didn't win their independence then, and there were still more battles to fight and more problems that they had to face. Eventually, they won out, and Maximilian was captured, and he was executed by firing squad. So it was a tragic end to a crazy story. But that battle took place on the 5th of May. That's what that date signifies. Why am I even talking about this? What are we talking about? Where have I heard that before? I just find it interesting, the details of history. 888-914-9149. How about Megan now in Green Bay, California? Hi, Megan.
Hi, Patrick, and everybody. Thank you so much also for having Taco Tuesday and talking about it. And I finally had my Taco Tuesday last night on Thursday, and that was wonderful. I'm such a fan of Mexican food.
Me too.
So, yes. Thank you. I could tell you had an extra spring in your step after the last Taco Tuesday Wednesday morning.
Yeah.
Thank you. So my question was just about Holy Communion. I'm always a learning Catholic, mm-hmm. and I'm not a cradle Catholic so much as I was baptized in the church at age 31, and I'm 48, and I'm 48. So my question is, how can we know for sure that we, as Catholics, that the only way to obey the command of Jesus, take this, all of you, my body, which is given up for you, how can we know that the only valid way to obey Jesus is in our traditional church setting with our priests who have gone through all of our modern day traditional aspects of becoming an official priest in the Catholic Church? Mm-hmm. Can we really be sure that that's the only valid way to obey Jesus?
The short answer is yes, and I'll elaborate so you can understand how we can know this. So first of all, we look at the primacy of sacred scripture here, which stands above everything else. And scripture tells us that at the Last Supper, Jesus, he had his disciples with him at the Last Supper, but they're also identified as the 12 apostles. Those were the disciples who were there, the 12 apostles. And at the Last Supper, Jesus does a couple of things. A couple of things that pertain to your question. He tells them when he takes the bread and says, "This is my body that will be given up for you." And he says with the chalice of wine, "This is my blood that will be poured out for you and for many." And then he tells them to do this. What I'm doing, you're going to do. I want you to do this. And they understood this. Now, when we read the words on the page, without recourse to having been in the room, none of us was, without recourse to maybe talking to one of the apostles who was in the room, we, by reading the words on the page, we can arrive at different conclusions. Well, what did this mean? Is this just a memorial meal? Did he mean, like, whenever you do this, think about me? Or do this, and when you do this, what did he mean by this? Does this mean literally this is his body and this is his blood? I mean, that's what he said, after all. He didn't say this is like my body, or this will remind you of my body, or this symbolizes my body. He said these words, this is my body. But just reading the page in Scripture, could reasonable people could come up with different conclusions as to what that meant, because it's not clear in an absolutely, you know, exhaustive sense. So what do we do? Well, we turn to the people who were in the room, the 12 apostles, and how do we know, what did they understand? What did they understand this to mean? So even though St. Paul himself wasn't in the room, because he wasn't one of the 12 apostles, Jesus revealed this to him, as he describes to us in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, and he gives a very clear rendition of what was done at the Last Supper, even though he wasn't there physically, and it matches up with what the gospel accounts say. And in two cases, Matthew and John, they were in the room with Jesus. So we now have St. Paul giving us a description, and that's immediately after that. That's where he talks about how you shouldn't receive communion if in an unworthy manner, nor if you don't discern or recognize the body. So we're seeing here like links in a chain. In the New Testament, many different things are talked about. The Eucharist is talked about. But what we see next is the people who knew the apostles. So I'm thinking of people like St. Ignatius of Antioch, who knew St. John. He was a disciple of St. John. He learned the gospel directly from one of the 12 apostles, St. John. It seems he also knew St. Peter. And he, in his writings, and what has passed down to us, are seven letters that he wrote to six different churches, and then one to Polycarp on his way from Antioch to Rome to be martyred. And in his writings, in invoking, as he did, the fact that he received these things from the Apostle John, he elaborates further, and he talks about how there is only a valid Eucharist only where the bishop is, and the priests who are with the bishop. I'm paraphrasing what he said here, but here we are at the beginning of the second century. So all the apostles have by now died. He was a very old man, probably about 80, and he learned all this from the Apostle John, and perhaps even also St. Peter. And he's talking about the real presence of Jesus in the Eucharist, and he's saying that this is only valid if it is done in connection with the bishop and the presbyters who surround him, you know, the priests of that diocese, the priests who are associated with the bishop. So here we see now this third link of the chain. So we have from Jesus to the apostles, from the apostles to the next generation who learned it from them. And now by that early point, we see them talking about it's only valid if you receive it in this context from the bishop or from one of the priests associated with the bishop. So that's another link in the chain. And then from there, and I don't want to belabor the point, Megan, but what you can see historically is this torrent of theological reflection and theological precision in which the early church fathers emphasize that in order to have a valid Holy Eucharist that really is, as St. Ignatius of Antioch says, the flesh of Jesus that suffered for our salvation on the cross, the only way to have that is if you are a validly ordained bishop or priest. And so what we see is the seminal doctrine appearing in Scripture, elaborated much more so by those eyewitnesses, or more importantly, by those who knew the eyewitnesses. And then from there, it becomes very specific and very emphatic. So for that reason, when you say, how can we be sure, what we need to do is just say, let's look at what those early Christians believed. They got it from the apostles. They got it from those who knew the apostles. And they were really clear that the Holy Eucharist is only valid, it only is really Jesus if it has been consecrated by a validly ordained bishop or priest. Now, that's kind of a quickie overview of it, but there are whole books devoted to this. I would recommend a book, for example, called The Hidden Manna by James T. O'Connor. It's a one-book theology of the Eucharist, and it goes through lots of these details, even more than I have time to talk about on the radio.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome. Now, sometimes you can give a quick answer, like, yes, it's true. You can only have a valid Eucharist from somebody who's validly ordained. But without the explanation in the background, that may not be persuasive to people. But hopefully you feel a little more persuaded now.
I do. That's fascinating about the one who was, which Saint Martyr
That was Ignatius of Antioch.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And Antioch is the first group to call themselves Christians ever, right? Okay.
Yeah, in fact, what's interesting is that the term Christian was actually a put-down originally. It was an epithet. It would have been like saying, oh, you Christers, you know, it was a term of derision that was attached to the Christians, but they embraced it. And they said, you're right, we are Christians. We follow Christ. We believe in Jesus Christ. So it went from being a put-down to a badge of honor.
Thank you.
You're welcome. One other thing, Megan, parting gift. One thing you will not find anywhere in the early church is people saying that the Eucharist is just a symbol, that it's just bread, it's just wine. You won't find that anywhere in the early church. It was universally acclaimed and believed, and martyrs died for this, that once was bread and wine at Mass becomes the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus. That was the universal belief. The reason? Because they were Catholic. Thanks, Megan. I'll be right back.